Jawad alayhi salam. We find that in one of these great debates in which Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was in, of course, just for a little bit of a background, we have these debates in the time of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, and Imam Rida alayhi salam, who was the eighth divinely appointed Imam. The Islamic lands were full of these translations of philosophical and theological and different scientific texts. And so clearly the Muslims began to have new questions about these various subjects. In one such sitting, a person asked Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam about the attributes of Allah. Now, he said, why is our Lord called gentle? And so in response, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said, we call Allah gentle because he knows everything about every tiny thing, even including small insects and things that are even tinier than insects. Allah knows the position of their organs, their reason, their lust, their copulation, their sympathy with their own descendants, their communications with one another, carrying food to their offsprings, whether they are in the mountains or valleys or deserts. We know that their Creator, Allah, is gentle without manner, because manner is for fashioned creatures. In this beautiful dialogue and this beautiful debate, if you will, between this person who asked Imam al-Jawad the meaning of being gentle, and in response we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam gave a beautiful description of the attributes of Allah, to the point where we learn that Allah knows every single thing, whether small or large. And so when we know that Allah, who is the most caring, the most kind, the most forgiving, the most merciful, the sustainer of everything and the provider of rizq and sustenance, then we begin to truly trust and love Allah, the Almighty. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth Imam. What is zinat? Beauty. But let us go to the hadith of the Imam, where Imam talks about a zinat in a very different level. Imam talks about the reality of life. Our life is nothing but bala. Bala means test and trial. And the Imam says, even when you go through difficulties and test and trial, look for the zenith and beauty in that situation. And what is it? As-sabru zinatul bala. Patience and sabr is the beauty of bala. And this is where we have to realize that, you know, our life is ibtila. It is imtihan. It is test and trial. And this is where we have to emphasize the issue of patience and sabr. In Surah Al-Asr, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he summarizes the pillars of success for a human being, he talks about iman, amal salih, and then he says counseling about haqq, and at the end he says counseling about sabr. Tawasaw bil haqq wa tawasaw bis sabr. To the extent that our Prophet says, the relationship of sabr with iman is the relationship of the head to the body. If you don't have the head, your body is dead. The Prophet says, if you don't have sabr, your iman will not be alive. Our imams also talk about a concept known as al-bala lil-bala. The bala sometimes comes because Allah wants to test our vila and our love. We think, okay, just saying, you know, I love Allah, I love you, I love the Prophet, I love the Imam of the time, it's not sufficient. Allah says, if you're really true, let me see. I'll put you in bala and see whether you still are able to maintain your iman and faith or not. So al-bala lil-bala, you know, the test and trial comes in order to see whether we are firm and truthful in our claim of love of Allah, Rasul, and Imam or not.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The 2022 EU Ambassadors Conference was launched on Monday in Brussels against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine and its global consequences. Ambassadors from the EU's 145 delegations and offices around the world took part.
This is a perfect storm. First, prices increasing. Everybody's running to increase interest rates. This will bring us to a world recession.
Tensions between the West and Russia are rising. One official in Moscow claims a truck was used to attack the Crimean Bridge last Saturday and had travelled through EU nation Bulgaria. The European Commission was asked to respond.
There are so many things coming out of Moscow and from these official so-called places which don't really merit any commentary. I mean, let me recall that the Crimea is Ukraine.
No one has yet claimed responsibility, but some analysts say the move was a strategic mistake.
The threats of a nuclear conflict are becoming more and more real. And I think it wasn't wise, it was really provocative to attack the bridge, especially military. Whoever did it, they haven't reached any significant result because the bridge resumed functioning the very same day.
12 months ago, EU agency the European Court of Auditors determined Ukraine is corrupt to the core. Despite this, the nation is set to become part of the EU's long-term budget. The European Commission says Kiev needs 3.5 billion euro per month to run the country.
Since the beginning of the war, we have supported Ukraine financially with Team Europe with up to 19 billion euros. This is not including the military capability and equipment support.
Fighting intensified on Monday as Russia's military struck Kiev and other Ukrainian cities. The latest position from the West's perspective is due to become clearer later this week when a meeting of NATO defence ministers takes place here in the Belgian capital. Also, an EU leaders' summit is due to take place here at the end of next week. Analysts are not anticipating there will be many references made to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A study presented by the Bank of Italy on Monday raised the alarm on the Italian company's sentiment on the future. According to the report, based on information gathered between August 15 and September 15, spiraling inflation and uncertainty linked to the conflict in Ukraine have badly dented optimism. The Bank of Italy surveyed companies in the industrial and service sectors with at least 50 employees.
Bank of Italy's data was somehow predictable. One just needs to talk to people to realize how worrying the situation is. Maybe we must be aware that the financialization of the economy, a long-standing issue, is aggravating the economic situation and that companies must stop seeking high profits in a short span of time.
A third of the firms surveyed said difficulties related to rising energy costs had worsened in the previous 3 months, sparking a downward revision in the investment plans for the remainder of the year. The war between Ukraine and Russia has made an Italian energy crisis much worse. Italy received 40% of its gas imports before the conflict from Russia.
We are witnessing a spike in energy prices, which is only partially due to a shortage of supplies, and also has roots in speculative strategies which threaten thousands of companies and alarm families.
The leader of a right-wing coalition that won elections about 2 weeks ago, Giorgia Meloni, is likely to become Italy's next prime minister. Meloni will face no shortage of challenges, from the budget and recovery plans to finding unity with allies and deciding how to handle the Ukraine-Russia war. So far, the Mario Draghi's government has spent 66 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. Italy's finances are set to be further put to the test as analysts predict the next government will be forced to increase fiscal aid or even to resort to a budgetary slippage. Max Civilli, Rome.
Dressed in their Sunday's best and singing words of praise, thousands of Muslims from around the world descended upon the northwest English town of Bolton to celebrate a historical figure whose legacy transcends time and space. Prophet Muhammad, his birthday called the Maulid, celebrated in the third month of the Islamic calendar.
For these Muslims and millions of others around the world, Prophet Muhammad is an ethical and spiritual role model, and commemorating his life is another way of keeping his memory alive in the collective Muslim consciousness.
And it is that and his many other characteristics which attract these Muslims to the joyous occasion. The young are eager to tell us what the Prophet means to them.
Inspiration, and undoubtedly the most honest person you can ever think of, best of all mankind, and the one you should actually truly believe in. Like, you can say, I believe in this person because he's a good man, good job. This person is the one you can really say, and with your heart and faith, say, I believe in him.
He means everything to me. He showed me how to live my life, how to treat other people. You know, how the way I'd want to be treated is the same way I treat other people.
As well as making the Prophet and his legacy a constant in the lives of Muslims, the event sets out to change misconceptions among non-Muslims in the wake of insults against the Prophet in Europe in recent years and increased religious hate crimes on his followers.
Our religion that the beloved Prophet Muhammad has given us is a religion of peace, love and harmony, and it's to build unity and community, to bring the communities together with love and harmony.
At the same time as their female counterparts celebrating in a nearby building, the men engage in prayers and reciting the Quran, followed by delicious free food, a symbol of the Holy Prophet's largesse. Saeed Puriza, Bolton.
The Silicon Valley of Iran, Paradis Technology Park, is home to heavyweight tech firms, from fintech to medical and robotics companies. Here, in the 20th Paradis Annual Summit, Paradis Park acknowledged the top brands that have made major contributions to the country's economic growth.
So
We produce mining, drilling, and extraction machinery, including road headers, side dump loaders, conveyors, bolts, as well as junction boxes. Our products are built based on international standards. We're planning to export to other countries, starting from Turkey.
We're producing all of the supplements and medicines that have a high degree of technology based on biotechnology or human medicines, veterinary medicines, and so on.
Located in west of Tehran, Paradis Technology Park was launched in 2001 with the aim of offering financial and consulting support to small enterprises and commercializing their products. Currently, it has 400 companies under its belt, many of which have turned into tech giants.
Inside the park, we try to provide many kind of facilities and services for these companies. Some of them are professional services, including, for example, some kind of consultancies like as legal and financial consultancies, providing some kind of services for them.
Paradis Technology Park predicts that this year, the total export of products from its firms will hit the $50 million mark.
These companies now are exporting to more than 30 countries all over the world, and the number of products which are exporting now is more than 100 high-tech products. And this is a brilliant achievement for us in this situation, and also according to the sanction, these companies now are exporting to other countries.
With U.S. sanctions still haunting the Iranian economy, the country has in recent years attached greater significance to domestic brands. The government is increasingly supporting companies active in non-oil sectors as part of efforts to reduce its dependence on crude revenues, which have faced a slump in the wake of U.S. sanctions.
Each one of these brands started out as a small startup and later grew to make a name for themselves in the market. Paradis Tech Park says it continues to support knowledge-based companies and help them develop, as it believes this will lead to a more resilient economy that will be safe from the ups and downs of the oil sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him. The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abd al-Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the holy book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance.
I call on the coalition of aggressors to end their war and lift the blockade and to end their occupation of our land. Just as I call on our Yemeni people to continue their resistance against our enemies for as long as their aggression continues, we consider this to be an Islamic duty and a holy war that we must commit to.
The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Thousands of Muslims have held a gathering in Pakistani capital Islamabad to celebrate the birth anniversary of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad.
The occasion is one of the key festivities on the Islamic calendar and holds a special significance for the Muslims around the world. The same goes for the people of Pakistan, who are always excited about commemorating this day.
The participants in the ceremonies say that the day provides Muslims with a great opportunity to understand the teachings and the message of Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet's teachings are still resonating in the society. This is a time to remember and follow the teachings of our Prophet and his family, who dedicated their lives for the great cause of Islam.
This day reminds us of the message of the Holy Prophet. He teaches us to forget our differences and live in peace and harmony with a sense of brotherhood.
In Islamabad, many of the public and private buildings, as well as streets, markets and mosques, are decorated with buntings and illuminated to mark the auspicious occasion. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him.
We are here to send a message to the world and our enemies that our Islamic nation will never abandon our beloved Prophet and that we will always follow his path and the examples of our leaders from the Prophet's household.
The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the Holy Book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance. The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed a new classified policy that limits the country's drone operations and tightens the rules of engagement. This policy will limit drone operations in several countries where the U.S. has carried out many strikes in recent years, including Afghanistan. U.S. drones, however, are still flying in the skies of Afghanistan, and people are worried that deadly strikes could still happen any moment.
Of course, in this case, people are receiving the harsh impacts more than the government. Such attacks create mental conditions for us. We don't feel safe and always feel threatened. When they fly over our sky, they make the days and nights horrific.
Surely the drones make us worry. We know they have special targets, but we have also seen civilians being targeted too. When we hear them flying, we get scared, especially the children.
Back in 2017, the Trump administration replaced old guidelines with a looser set of rules for drone engagement that led to a 330% rise in civilian casualties in Afghanistan. A research by an independent media organization shows that from 2015 to 2020 alone, between 300 to 900 civilians lost their lives to U.S. drone operations. Experts say that even with the new policy adopted, U.S. drones in Afghanistan are still dangerous.
The U.S. government, according to its hegemonic dominance worldwide, is always after fulfilling their national interests. If their national interests require it, drone attacks could take place anyway. According to the policy, the attack permit only goes to a higher authority rather than commanders. Biden would sign the attack permit.
The aforementioned policy requires near certainty that a target is a member of a designated terrorist group and near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured before pulling the trigger. But it still remains unclear what this near certainty standard means in practice. The precision of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan has always been under question. There have been many examples of misguided U.S. strikes, notably an attack just before the withdrawal of U.S. forces last year that killed 10 members of a family. People here are still concerned that they might be the next target. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul.
I'm heading with Donbass militia fighters to a frontline position outside the city of Donetsk. Ukrainian soldiers are only 70 meters away. I'm told not to film the skyline or any prominent markers so as not to give away their positions. The cramped living quarters are dark and dank. A fighter with the call sign Yidra, meaning the otter, gives me a tour.
We live here not in trenches but under concrete. These are destroyed buildings that we've old basements. It is all dug out by hands, down the narrow passageways, and understand what it's like to be a miner. We live here, breathe this air. You can't survive artillery any other way. At least you can hide from snipers, but not from artillery. Big caliber artillery, too.
He shows me a picture sent to him by his daughter. I asked him what has motivated him to fight in these conditions for the last 8 years.
Because this is where I live. My mother lives 25 kilometers from here. I speak Russian. My mom and dad speak Russian. I was a miner here. It's my land.
A young fighter, barely 18. The grueling nature of this war is bringing a seamlessly endless wave of young men on both sides to fight. A motivational poster. It reads, Donbass was never made to kneel by anybody, and nobody will be able to do it.
We understand that the USA are ruling this circus. Europe needs to stop being their vassals. America doesn't care about others. Their only way is to be at war, and they build their domestic policy out of conflicts with other countries. In Syria, they played the card of radical Islam, and now they're playing the card of fascism. They need war's blood and cruelty, and they signed Europe up to it too. They missed only one thing, that Russia will not stop fighting.
While there is raging ethnic hatred of Russians in Ukraine, after interviewing dozens of soldiers and civilians in Donbass, despite the war, I've yet to hear any ethnic hatred of Ukrainians.
We don't blame all Ukrainian people. Ukrainian people are our friends and relatives. Those who study this understand that one-third of Europe are cousins. Ukrainians, Belarusians, Slovaks, Poles, and Slovenians. They're all Slovak people. Ordinary people are not to blame for this. We think they're just corrupted by evil.
Out many Ukrainians who want peace negotiations with Russia, but are scared to speak up. Indeed, President Zelensky was elected in 2019 of war in the East, but the sad truth looks set to escalate further. Peace in Ukraine has never looked less likely than it does now. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Rates of anxiety and depression have decreased since first year of the coronavirus pandemic, but there are still aren't enough psychiatrists and therapists for millions of American patients. We now present you an article written by Eric Berger. The piece is titled, A Collective Trauma, COVID Keeps Its Grip on Mental Health of Many American Patients. Eric Wood, a mental health professional who leads virtual support groups for Indiana judges and attorneys, can look at a screen full of heads nodding in reaction to what someone said and know that the meeting is providing some relief for participants who have struggled during the COVID-19 pandemic. Eric Wood, who lives in Indianapolis, can also see how his wife, Diane Keller Wood, has made gradual improvements in her recovery from long COVID's significant effects on her mental and physical well-being. Eric Wood, a clinical case manager for the Indiana Judges and Lawyers Assistance Program, said, "This was probably me being more of a therapist than a husband, but I was really trying to get her to focus on the positive aspects and not to see everything with kind of a negative filter." He added, "And then eventually she started coming home from doctor's appointments saying, you know, I think I'm getting better." Still, Diane Keller Wood and the jurist, like millions of other Americans, have not fully recovered from the mental health problems connected to the COVID-19 pandemic and the surrounding societal upheaval over the last 2.5 years. While there are indications that at least among U.S. adults, the rates of anxiety and depression have decreased from the spike seen during the first year of the pandemic, they still remain higher than before COVID, and there still aren't enough psychiatrists and therapists. In short, while the pandemic is no longer the top story in the news each night, its ripple effects remain top of the mind for many Americans. Roxanne Cohen-Silver, a University of California at Irvine psychologist who has described the pandemic as a collective trauma, said, "In addition to those who died from COVID or lost a loved one to the virus, there are personal stressors that people have had to encounter on and off with restrictions in their activities, on and off with the possibility of getting ill. And all of those things have now been chronic." According to the National Center for Health Statistics, in 2019, 11% of American adults in the United States reported symptoms of anxiety and depression. In January of 2021, the number was 41%. A year later, it had fallen to 32%, which was still significantly higher than before the COVID pandemic. Before the pandemic, the Lawyers Association program operated monthly support groups for people struggling with problems such as addiction or grief. When much of the country entered lockdown because of the virus, the organization launched a weekly program, Connection Group, to help people grapple with the isolation. Wood said, "We have got some folks in the group that identify themselves as extroverts, and the pandemic was particularly difficult for them," adding, "Working from home really changed their sense of activity with other people. Conversations were cut. Anything social was just gone out of their lives." Wood said, "But even one of the litigators started again working in person. Their mental health challenges did not evaporate. In some cases, they got worse." Eric Wood noted, "When people started returning to the offices, attorneys in particular were just starting to fall apart," adding, Substance use for many really went out of control over the two-year period. Depressive disorders also are on the rise. Eric Wood added, still, despite the mounting concerns and the novelty of meeting virtually, the support groups appear to work. People who previously might not have driven 2 hours to attend a support group could now do so from the comfort of their homes. Eric Wood added, the Connections group has created its own kind of sense of community. We have had people that came in when a crisis was particularly relevant for them, and then things settled down, and then they stopped coming to group, but it's really met a need. Once COVID restrictions eased, Eric Wood and his colleagues considered stopping the Connections group or meeting less regularly, but participants asked to keep the same schedule. After many people had stopped worrying about COVID, Diane Keller Wood, a hearing aid attendant, contracted the virus in February of 2022, despite remaining vigilant about wearing a face mask. And then she developed long COVID symptoms, including difficulty breathing, fatigue, brain fog, loss of balance, and eye twitching. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, almost 1 in 5 U.S. adults who have had COVID continued to have long COVID symptoms in June. Diane Keller Wood has seen a long list of providers, including an ear, nose and throat doctor, a neurologist, a physical therapist, a psychiatrist, and an ophthalmologist. According to a study conducted at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, for about a month she experienced suicidal ideation, which is more common among people who have had COVID. Diane Keller Wood described it as the worst despair you have ever been through, with really no reason. Dr. Ziad Al-Ali, clinical epidemiologist at Washington University, who has studied the impact of the virus and long COVID on people's mental health, said, people with COVID-19 unfortunately have a much higher risk of having mental health issues. She said the psychiatrist prescribed Diane Keller Wood a mood stabilizer, which helped me tremendously. Keller Wood also connected with a member of a COVID survivors support group who recommended she try the over-the-counter drugs Pepcid and Zyrtec, which studies have shown can help with some COVID symptoms. She said they helped ease Keller Wood's brain fog, but some days she still has trouble forming words. She said, if I can just have quality of life and see some improvement, I think I will remain positive, but I don't know what my life is going to look like 10 years down the road. Another challenge is a lack of therapists and psychiatrists. According to Kaiser Family Foundation data, more than a quarter of the U.S. population lives in an area where there is a shortage of mental health providers. Dr. Ziad Al-Ali said, to address the swell of mental health problems, we need to be creative. He said that could mean the healthcare system forming support groups and social workers providing mental health care. Dr. Ziad Al-Ali added, the government has to do a whole lot more, and also the public has to be aware of this and restore some social ties and restore some sense of normalcy of checking on each other. Tim Bostwick, an opera singer and doctoral candidate in music at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is working on a creative solution for his post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. He had never had significant anxiety or depression before being hospitalized for COVID in spring of 2021 and developing long COVID symptoms. He also developed nodules on his vocal folds, which prevented him from singing for 6 months. He said, since recovering from COVID, I woke up with nightmares almost nightly, most of them being back in the hospital. But his mental health has improved because of medications and cognitive behavioral therapy. In public, Bostwick used to panic when he saw others not wearing face masks. He is now preparing to perform for the first time since the pandemic began. He'll be singing at Chicago Fringe Opera. He said, "Losing my voice was like losing an old friend, and we're not the same. We're never going to be the same. There's no going back to normal." He added, "But it's like getting to know an old friend again."
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim, Shia scholars, and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So today we want to talk about a Muslim Shiite Lebanese author and historian, Sayyid Hassan Amin Ameli, the son of Sayyid Mohsen Amin Ameli, who is very much famous, the author of A'yan al-Shia. And this man, Sayyid Hassan Amin Ameli, is the author of Da'atul Ma'rifatul Islamiyya al-Shia and also Mustadak A'yan al-Shia. Before getting to his works and his main research method in compiling his magnum opus, let's be more familiar with his early life, Sheikh Ziyaniya.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Sayyid Hassan Amin was born in 1908 in Damascus in Syria. And of course, on those days, this country was not named as Syria because it was before the World War One, and it was the Ottoman Empire in those days.
Okay.
He started primary studies in Shaqra, close to Damascus. Yes. And during World War One, he moved with his family to a small city in Jabal Amal. And he continued his studies in Damascus and in Madrasatul Alawiya. And then he moved to Iraq. Of course, before moving to Iraq, he started his Islamic studies in Damascus and in Syria with his father, because his father was a knowledgeable scholar, Sayyid Mohsen Al-Amin. And besides Islamic studies, he achieved his bachelor in law. And we should know that this Sayyid Hassan Amin, after studying in Hausa, he went back to Lebanon and Syria and started a job as a lawyer and as a judge also.
Okay.
Before World War II, he moved to, he was in Iraq, and he was teaching in a high school there, and he was studying also Islamic studies. Even for a period of his life, he was wearing this uniform, I mean turban, and you know, this long uniforms that is...
The clerical robe, you
yeah,
mean.
The clerical uniform.
Yes.
But during World War II, he went to Lebanon and became the judge of Nabatiya city.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he went back to Iraq. But after this period, he went back to Lebanon and Syria and started the compiling the Encyclopedia of Shia, or Da'iratul Ma'arif al-Islamiyya al-Shi'iyya.
That's all right. And this is his most outstanding work beside Mustadak Ayan Shia Sheikh Mahdavi. First of all, with Ayan Shia, the Mustadak of Ayan Shia, it was a contribution to his father's work, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, you're right. So I think before we start talking about his works, we have to acknowledge the huge works that he has done in this field of study. Even though some critics might be directed to his works, yes, by the scholars. So as you said, one of the very good work that he did was to accomplish the work of his father. As it is mentioned in his biography, Sayyid Mohsen Amin didn't complete this very famous book, A'yan al-Shia, which is responsible for introducing the A'yan, meaning the famous knowledgeable scholars of Shia from the birth of Islam up until now, or up until the time of the Sayyid Mohsen Amin. So he only reached till the letter Sin.
Yes.
He didn't accomplish after the letter Sin. I mean, those names which are starting with the letter Sin,
okay,
were not put in the format of the book. It was only some drafts not being organized and putting in order. So first thing first he did was to accomplish the work of his father. Besides that, he did a kind of complementary voluminous book called Mustadraku A'yan al-Shia. Mm-hmm. When we say Mustadrak,
yes,
this is a kind of, or better to say, this is a field of authoring books.
Yes.
Sometimes a famous scholar writes something on one specific subject. The following scholars may discover some shortcomings based, okay, on the, let's say, work that they have done. So they will put their efforts in a title of Mustadrak.
Yes.
Meaning that whatever this author has meant to finish, mm-hmm, but didn't include, we have included in, okay, our book. So this is called the field of Mustadrak, or writing Mustadrak.
Okay.
So it's always attaching to something which is presented as the main thing.
That's right.
And then we have the Mustadrak, meaning that whatsoever from, mm-hmm, the shortcomings or, okay, shortages that the main author didn't include in his book, we are going to include it in our version of book.
And the people who write Mustadrak has to be a scholar themselves, isn't it?
Definitely. Why? Because, okay, they have to have a very vast and comprehensive knowledge,
uh-huh, okay,
in a way that they are aware of all details being presented in that, okay, book, and then those details which are not presented in the book, and they have this aim and intention to, mm-hmm, complete it. So
that's
better,
right,
to the, I don't know if it is correct to,
yes,
give this title as a complementary
book,
book to,
yes,
the main one. So this Mustadrak Ayan Shia that he authored, mm-hmm, is a kind of book like this.
That's right.
And besides these two very interesting work, we call this Encyclopedia of the Shia.
Yes.
This is also, yes,
Daratul
Ma'arif,
yeah. Yes.
This is also could be regarded as one of the unique work as his time.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because at that time we see that, I don't know if our listeners are aware of the writing the Encyclopedia of Islam in the academia, we see that the first edition has been published from the year 1913 up until 1938. So something around 25 years will take a group of scholars worldwide,
mm-hmm,
to write the Encyclopedia of Islam. This is the first edition, and they took it to the second edition, which is finished in 2009. So it,
okay,
was a kind of half a century work. It started,
yes,
the writing of the Encyclopedia of Islam started in 1954 up until 2005.
That's right.
Why am I telling this information,
mm-hmm,
for our listeners? Not to undermine the work,
yes,
being done with this scholar. So he was doing this on his own,
mm-hmm,
or if there was a group, very short group, very small group, but we see those encyclopedias being presented on the subject of Islam, and he felt that the information being presented over there,
yes,
are not correct, specifically regarding the Shia.
That's right.
So he had this intention, he had this pure intention to do his best in order to present our type of the Encyclopedia of Shia.
That's right.
And his work must be acknowledged and appreciated.
Okay. More than 40 years of his life have been spent on compiling such a book.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
But Sheikh Ziyaniya, we say Daratul Ma'rifatul Islamiyya, Encyclopedia of Islam, Ash-Shi'iyya. Okay, what is the Shia content of this encyclopedia? I mean, what is it about?
You know, because Sayyid Hassan Amin faced with a copy of Encyclopedia of Islam that was translated into Arabic, and he studied that book, and he faced articles about Ahlus Sunnah. So when he studied that book, he understood that the articles that are related to Sunni ideas and Sunni school of thought have been edited by Sunni scholars who have translated that book into Arabic from English. But the articles about Shia are full of, you know, misunderstandings and, you know, wrong ideas about Shia school of thought. That's why he decided to correct this, you know, problem. So everything that is related to Shia school of thought, no matter it is related to cities or people, of course, about scholars, because Ayanu Shia is, compiled by him and his father. So he does not talk about, great figures of Shia in this encyclopedia. But, for example, about Imamah, about the concept of Ismah, about the concept of Hadith, these different issues or different cities in, Shia territories, he decides to discuss about these issues and bring, data that is collected from Shia resources and also Sunni resources. He is not only, taking his data and information from Shia resources. So he is trying to derive out and to, exhibit the Shia concepts in a true way, so that's correct the misunderstandings that has been put in the book of Encyclopedia of Islam.
That's all right. How many volumes is it, Sheikh Mahtavi, and what is the content? I mean, what are the titles?
Actually, it was published in 11 volumes.
Okay.
But newly, the same thing has been published in 26 volumes.
Okay.
And the titles, the same as other encyclopedia that are starting with the alphabet letters, so alphabetically they are trying to include all of the entries that have something to do with the Shia school of thought, from the scholars, books, places, sites, everything.
And the entries are, for example, given to different scholars to write on the topic?
Nothing has been mentioned regarding this, and he is trying to say that almost half of my lifespan, 40 years, I put forth to do such a thing. He is not mentioning anything regarding that. It's not like the works that are being done by that very professional scholars.
So, Sheikh, this has been the first serious work, isn't it, regarding writing encyclopedia on Shia Islam. Any criticism regarding this, encyclopedia?
Because, as you mentioned, this book is the first in this category, We have other books like Dairatul Ma'arif Buzurgi Islami or Islamika that is written by a Muslim group in or Muslim team in Tehran. And it is published in simultaneously in Arabic, English and Persian.
Yes.
And also other encyclopedias like The Danishnami Islam or Danishnami Jahan Islam, that these two are in Farsi and Persian. But because this book, I mean, Dairatul Ma'arif al-Islamiyya al-Shi'iyya was the first, so it's obviously there are some, you know, points about this, you know, book that we should consider them that, okay, because it was the first experience.
Yes.
So it's, you know, simply acceptable that it's something normal, that because the also the author was doing this work on his own. Of course, he was taking some assistance from some, you know, scholars.
Yes.
But the main task was on him.
That's right.
So maybe we would say that some articles in this book are not, you know, compiled as it should be done, you know, in an encyclopedia way.
Yes, yes.
So this is one of the points that we should mention about this book. Another one is that some articles are not, you know, at the end of these articles, the resources are not mentioned.
Yes.
So
the references are not given. Okay.
Yeah, so that's these are two important points that we should consider about this book.
Okay. And as we know, writing an encyclopedia is a teamwork. It needs, we can say, a team of professionals. So for somebody spending 40 years of his life on that, it is really precious, I think. I believe it is precious, and we must be thankful to such scholars to spend their time and life on such books. Okay, that's all right. Dairatul Ma'arif al-Islamiyya al-Shi'iyya, written by Sayyid Hassan Amin al-Amili. May Allah bless his soul. About his demise, it is mentioned that, that's all right. It was 2002, 1423, according to the Hijri calendar, Sha'ban 8th, that he passed away. And he was buried in Lebanon. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Hassan Amin al-Amili, the author of Mustadak Ayan al-Shia and also Dairatul Ma'arif al-Islamiyya al-Shi'iyya. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdavi, and thank you much for your presence in this program, the program The Teacher. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.